Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, August 9th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin with a piece from the College of Financial Aid called UI Offers Safeguards to Guardianship Loophole. House Committees Host Joint Hearing in Chicago by Julie Wirth, Chicago. University of Illinois officials are calling on state lawmakers to review guardianship laws, consider licensing restrictions on educational consultants, and add more college counselors in Illinois high schools to combat a new college financial aid ploy. UI Admissions Director Andy Borst and Financial Aid Director Michelle Traim delivered those recommendations to legislators today while testifying at a joint hearing in Chicago. The hearing was called by two House committees after reporters from ProPublica Illinois and The Wall Street Journal found dozens of cases where parents in wealthy Chicago suburbs had given up custody of their teenager in order to qualify for college financial aid. The parents petitioned a court to place their children into the custody of guardians, often a family friend or relative, so their children could declare themselves financially independent and thereby qualify for student financial aid. That included need-based state monetary award program grants intended for students from lower-income families, a program that is chronically underfunded. College officials say the practice, aided by attorneys and a college consultant in the Chicago area, is technically legal but unethical. The students attended public and private universities in Illinois and out of state, including the UI. UI officials were tipped off to the practice by a suspicious high school counselor, and they found 4 applicants in 2018-19 and 11 more for the current school year who had entered guardianship but appeared to be still supported by their parents financially. The UI reduced or eliminated the financial aid that it had planned to provide to the students, but they still received thousands of dollars in MAP grants and federal Pell grants. Traim urged lawmakers to evaluate current guardianship transfer laws and practices to eliminate the loophole as the best long-term solution. A more immediate step would be to give university financial aid administrators more flexibility in how aid is distributed, she said in her prepared remarks. Traim said she can look at a student's status and adjust financial aid if a parent dies or loses a job, but she and her colleagues have no authority to reduce students' need-based aid if they come across pertinent information, Traim said. That authority would give administrators much stronger tools to immediately address cases such as the guardianship issue. Borst urged legislators to create a licensing or certification requirement for those who want to be independent educational consultants in Illinois. That industry, both nationally and in Illinois, is completely unregulated, Borst said, with no barriers to entry, no professional oversight, and no common ethics standards. Families facing the intense competition of college admissions trust those independent consultants, which can lead to bad decisions, like transferring guardianship, Borst said. The state should help families find ways to assess the competence and trustworthiness of the consultants, he said. Finally, Borst and Traim suggested more support for high school counselors to help families make the best college choices, calling them the heroes of this story. It was a tip from a high school counselor that led to the recent Varsity Blues scandal, and school counselors alerted UI officials to inconsistencies in applicants' financial information in the guardianship cases, he said. As of 2014, Illinois had a student-to-counselor ratio of more than 600 to 1, almost 200 more students than the national average, and 350 more than the recommended level, Borst said. Beefing up the number of counselors will make families feel less compelled to turn to people without appropriate credentials who could lead them astray, Borst said. Borst and Trame also urged legislators not to overcorrect and risk creating unintended consequences for students who are truly in economic hardship and often find the financial aid and college application process confusing and discouraging. Solution to this problem should not make a college education even harder to get for students who need help the most, they said. And in the same section, higher ed officials say custody ploy not a widespread issue, by Peter Hancock, Chicago. Officials from several public universities in Illinois told a panel of state lawmakers Thursday they do not believe there is widespread abuse of court-ordered guardianships that have enabled some students from wealthy backgrounds to obtain need-based student financial aid. While the practice appears to have happened several times at the University of Illinois, officials from other universities said they aren't aware of it happening at their schools. I can tell you that I have seen no indication of families having intentionally changed legal guardianship for financial aid purposes, said Terry Hare, financial aid director at Western Illinois. Officials at Southern Illinois, Illinois State, Eastern Illinois, and Northeastern Illinois all offered similar remarks. Lawmakers, meanwhile, appear unsure about how to prevent such abuses from happening in the future. While some suggested imposing tighter controls on financial applications, others suggested the problem might be the skyrocketing cost of higher education. A system that drives families to cheat is a broken system, said Representative Carol Ammons, Democrat from Urbana, chair of the House Higher Education Committee. The concern for many lawmakers is that tightening rules on financial aid or guardianship could end up hurting those children who need those services the most. Representative Dan Brady, Republican from Bloomington, the Republican spokesperson on the Higher Education Budget Committee, said he believes the problem is rooted in something that state government might have little ability to influence. I think we find ourselves in uncharted waters here, Brady said, and I don't know, as well-intended as all of us are on this committee, how we get to a point where we legislate moral and ethical behavior. And next, parking permits now required of Hoopston students, by Noel McGee, Hoopston. Ashley Baker has been looking forward to the day her daughter, Allison Watson, could finally drive to school almost as much as her daughter has. She's involved in a lot of extracurricular activities, she said of her daughter, an incoming junior at Hoopston Area High School. She sometimes has to be here really early in the morning or stay late. I babysit my niece and nephew, so it's going to be really convenient that she can drive herself back and forth. Baker was surprised to learn this summer that students who drive to school will have to pay to park, starting this year. But the more she thought about it, the more she likes the idea. It's going to be a safety improvement, and the cost is minimal, she said of the $10 a year permit fee. Hoopston school officials added the new parking permit policy to its student handbook when it updated the manual last spring, said Principal John Klaber. Arthur Lovington Atwood Hammond High School will also implement a policy this year, with permits costing $2 annually. They join a number of other East Central Illinois schools whose parking programs have been around for a while, some of them at least 25 years. What we're hoping to accomplish is really multifaceted, and the main reason has to do with school safety, Klaber said, adding students have been issued red permits, staff blue, and visitors will be required to display black ones while on campus, though staff and visitors don't pay. Through the course of the day, he continued, there are a lot of cars that come in and out, whether it's students, staff, or visitors. This is a way to help us know who is here in the event of a crisis situation. For example, if there were a situation where vehicles would need to be moved on the lot, Klaber said officials could figure out who they belonged to quickly. Even if we just had a car that was double parked or the lights were on, we could look and quickly get that student without disrupting the educational setting. Before, I'd have to get on the PA system and say, "Whoever has the blue Honda, please come to the office. Your lights are on," to find out who it belonged to. Klaber hopes the policy will also encourage safe driving on school grounds. If someone isn't following the rules of the road or being safe while in the parking lot, we can pull their tag, and they wouldn't be allowed to drive to school, he said. We have a lot of walkers, especially with the high school being attached to the middle school. Students need to know they have to be responsible and that safety is always paramount. Klaber said officials researched other schools' parking permit fees and tried to be mindful of the cost when setting hoopstones. For that reason, he said, students only pay for one permit, and they can transfer them to different vehicles. We have students who may drive their mom's car one day and a different car another day, he said. We did not want it to be a hindrance to anyone, but we still get all of the great benefits of moving to this. By Thursday morning, the third and final day of registration, the high school had issued 70 permits. Klaber anticipates that number will be closer to 100 when school starts and gradually increase to around 150 throughout the year as more sophomores get their driver's licenses. He added the fees will mostly pay for the tag, which is a high-quality material, he said. If there's money left over, we'll use it in buildings and grounds to help resurface our parking lots. Cost comparison. Around the area, Arcola, Fisher, Monticello, Paxton Buckley Loda, and Westville High Schools are among those who don't charge students to park. However, Monticello and Westville students are required to have a parking tag and place them in their windshield. This sticker just helps easily identify cars during supervision in an effort to more easily understand who is on our campus, Westville Superintendent Seth Miller said, adding the practice has been in place for more than a decade. Bismarck, Henning, Rossville, Alvin, Centennial, Muhammad Seymour, and Rantoul Township high school students are among those who fork over the most money for parking privileges. Rantoul reserves 17 spots in its parking lot for students, said Superintendent Scott Amario. One of those is given away at our post-prom event the year before, he said. The other spots can be rented for $50 per semester, he said. Amario said the fee raises about $1,600 a year, and the school uses the money for incentives and rewards for students. Seniority privileges. Centennial also has limited parking for students, said David Brower, Champaign School's communications director. The school and Muhammad Seymour both charge $50 a year. Due to construction, parking permits are offered to seniors first and then to others if there are any left, he said, adding that if they can't park on the lot, they have to find street parking. Brower said the fee revenue is used to offset costs for lot maintenance. Muhammad Seymour has taken in about an average of $16,000 in fees for the past 3 years, Superintendent Lindsay Hall said. It goes into the education fund and isn't earmarked for anything in particular. Their counterparts at Bismarck, Henning, Rossville, Alvin pay $10 a quarter or $49 a year. We make around $2,000 to $3,000 annually, said BHRA Superintendent Scott Watson, adding the parking fees have been in place for about 15 years. We use that money for minor parking lot repairs or snow removal costs. Eliminate chaos. Elsewhere, St. Joseph Ogden and Georgetown Ridge Farm students pay $20 a year. If they only need it for the second semester, then it is a $10 cost, said St. Joe Ogden Superintendent Brian Brooks. Brooks said his school's policy predates his tenure at the school, but the primary reason is we don't have enough parking spots typically for every student that can drive by the time we get to second semester. Our spots are also numbered, so this gives them a guaranteed spot no matter what time they come into school. Some of our students have late arrival or may even take a class at Parkland first thing in the morning. All of these things help eliminate chaos in the parking lot each day, which then creates a safer environment for kids. Like Georgetown Ridge Farm, St. Joe Ogden earmarks its fee revenue for parking lot maintenance. Meanwhile, at Salt Fork, the $5 a year fee students pay, along with registration fees, are put toward building supplies that go to benefit students, Superintendent Phil Cox said. It's a way to raise some additional revenue and for students to understand that driving to school is a privilege, not a right, Cox said. And from the Unit 4 schools, school board to vote on revised safety plans following complaints by Lindsay Jones, Champaign. Some Unit 4 parents say potential changes coming to the district's active shooter drilling procedures are partially a result of their prolonged efforts to get answers about the district's overall plan. School board members will vote Monday on a revised plan of ALICE, A-L-I-C-E, which stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate, drill implementation across the district, including adding a social worker and parents to district crisis planning processes, as well as a commitment to only have one announced drill this school year. Those changes mirror ones pitched in multiple months-long conversations between parents and Unit 4 officials and are documented in an official letter to the district. In addition to five solutions, the letter notes concerns about Unit 4's crisis plan. Parent Amy Averam said those concerns rose after a reunification drill last year where Southside Elementary students evacuated the building and were taken by bus to Memorial Stadium. The more we asked questions, the more concerned we became with the plan, she said. When they compared it to research on the subject, we were concerned that Unit 4 wasn't really following best practice guidelines and sort of doing things that were contrary to the trauma-informed principles they've been telling parents and staff they want to utilize. It felt like, at the district level, it was like they hadn't thought about these things. When some parents discovered that a September 2018 draft of the crisis plan called for two ALICE drills, one announced and one unannounced, they wondered why both were needed. And as they did more research, they wondered how students and staff would benefit from the unannounced one. Unannounced drills violate the best practice standards of professional organizations, such as the National Child Traumatic Stress Network and Safe and Sound Schools, the letter read. Additionally, experts suggest that surprise drills can desensitize students to a real incident. They are inappropriate for all children. Illinois state law only calls for schools to conduct one drill with law enforcement officials every year. It is unclear why Unit 4 mandates a second drill, the letter continued. There is no evidence-based research that supports this decision. Superintendent Susan Zola said Thursday that for the 2019-20 school year, there will be no unannounced drills, a change from the original plan presented informationally to the school board last year. Part of the board's job is to respond to stakeholders, so this year's drill will be announced, she said, adding that 1 year only is as far as we can commit. Prior to parents' concerns being raised, Southside parent Karen Johnson said it had been difficult to know whether the plan outlined in September could be changed. I think a big component is the communication. It's been hard to see if it's deliberately fluid or if it's changing as you're asking questions, she said. I think the fluidity is a good thing in that it signals that the district is willing to reconsider and change things as necessary. Better communication is another request parents are seeking from Unit 4 in their letter. They said officials should be using multiple channels, email, backpack letter, district social media, etc., to give detailed information about the drills. They said they haven't yet seen that to their satisfaction. The parents and the entire community have every right to find out what the plans are, said Edison parent Leslie Reagan. How they plan to do any kind of drill for active shooters, and how they plan to educate students and teachers for anything like that, and how they plan to address the trauma of practicing and discussing it. We deserve answers, and we deserve plans. Zola said after Monday's meeting, the district will send out communication related to its crisis plan to families. Reagan added that there were also concerns about volunteer parents in the school regarding the drills. Like staff and teachers, they too are being asked to play this role of defending the school and the kids, she said. Zola said the new plan built in optional training for families or community members to participate if they're really interested in what that drill looks like. And in response to calls for mental health professionals and parent representatives to be appointed to the district's crisis team, Zola said the district is considering adding a social worker and parents. Parents said the new plan may be a start to addressing concerns they have been raising for a while. It's been several months of trying to have meetings with different people in the district, Averam said. I was surprised that we needed to spend as much time as we did to encourage what I would consider very common-sense suggestions. Said Johnson, the reason we got to where we are now is incidental things that have happened. It's a result of our own digging and a lot of effort on our part. We've spent a lot of time asking questions, re-asking questions. It's not been easy to get those answers. I don't think it should have to be that hard to figure out what is happening to the schools or in the schools. On Monday, parents will find out whether all five of their requests, which include revising the ALICE presentation to students to be more developmentally appropriate and adding an opt-out option, have been incorporated and whether the board will approve the revision. Zola said the district is looking at revising the student presentation as well as starting the opt-out option with students with individualized education plans or 504s or students who have sensory concerns. I'm optimistic that the district and the board were willing to look at some suggestions from parents, Averam said. I would hope they would view family members as partners and not in an adversarial way. In a way, I'm cautious because I haven't seen the full plan, but I am hopeful that it will include these suggestions, which I do think make the plan better. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called A Lot is on the Line. There will soon be a lot more places in Illinois for people to place their bets. The owners of Fairmount Park, a racetrack near St. Louis, recently announced that they are adding slot machines, casino table games, and sports betting as part of plans for what could be an eventual $50 million expansion. One of three racetracks in Illinois, Fairmount is transitioning into a racino, thanks to a massive expansion of gambling approved by Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Illinois General Assembly. Fairmount President Brian Zander told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch the move is really going to save the place. Zander is not the only one who's betting that more gambling options will create a bright future, both for the state's horse racing industry and the state itself. Pritzker and legislators are positively drooling over what they expect to be an explosion of gambling revenues they expect will, at least in part, reverse Illinois' slide into effective bankruptcy. as the Illinois Gaming Commission lays the groundwork for the extensive administrative oversight that is required, this is what is in store for the people of Illinois. There are 10 existing casinos in Illinois. The new legislation provides for 6 more to be located in Chicago, Waukegan, Rockford, Danville, Williamson County, and an unchosen municipality in south suburban Cook County. The big enchilada, of course, is the proposed casino in Chicago, a massive 4,000-position facility that will almost certainly be a huge moneymaker. That means, of course, that there will be considerable maneuvering by a variety of power players and their political patrons for the right to be the recipient of the license to operate. Given the state's tawdry politics, it's fair to predict that the entire process will be steeped in sleazy politics and outright corruption. Not only is the state going to become home to 6 new casinos, assuming that there are entities vying to do business in the other 5 designated areas, all 16 will be bigger than the existing venues. They can double their capacity from 1,000 slots to 2,000. Just do the math. 10 existing casinos have 1,000 positions each, while 16 will have roughly 2,000 each. That's tripling of casino capacity. Of course, the racetracks won't really be racetracks anymore. Horse racing just isn't the attraction or the profitable business that it used to be. There'll also be, in effect, casinos, adding up to 1,200 table games and slot machines. As if Illinois doesn't already have enough video gambling, 32,000 plus machines statewide, even more will be coming. Finally, the Gaming Commission will oversee the establishment of a new form of gambling, sports wagering. It would be no surprise if that activity, too, proves to be popular. The question, of course, is how much is enough? Here's another more serious one. Just how many people, or how many, if any, opportunities should the state give for people to gamble away the rent money? The first is difficult to answer. The state lottery, horse racing, and casinos have seen their revenues drop as video gambling machines, introduced just a few years ago, grow in popularity. Indeed, gambling in the form of video gambling is cannibalizing gambling in the form of casinos, the lottery, and horse racing. Sure, there will be more gambling because there will be more venues offering different ways for people to lose their money. As for the second question, the answer clearly is that the state is interested in providing as many opportunities to gamble as it thinks will generate even an additional dollar in revenue. Desperate legislators have turned a blind eye to the social problems caused by legalized gambling and declared that it's every man for himself, sink or swim. They did the same thing when they decided that decriminalizing marijuana was insufficient because there's revenue to be gained by legalizing it, regardless of the anticipated social problems. The only real issue, in the eyes of the responsible officials, is how much money government will pay or will gain in additional revenue. It's a bet on the state's future that, resting on the concept of survival of the fittest, is far from a sure thing. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, August 9th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.